the negative, you wonder what in the world they're going to grow around there. But you'll see right here on the left, where the heavy green on there, this is where they now you can see what kind of country is in that Negev, with a part of pretty rugged territory.
What does the Negev mean again?
Desert. It's in one word, that was it, desert. That's a cool thing about it. And it's, what it amounts to is a communal form of government where everybody shares and shares alike. A socialistic form of government.
Is this where they give their lives to for the cause of Israel in labor, so called?
Is a judiciary system also? Do they have to mete out their own punishment in Israel?
I don't know about that. I do know that you go into it voluntarily and you can leave voluntarily. If you go into it a while and decide that that's not for you, then you're no stranger to tight. Most of the money made goes into a pool for the goods to enlarge it or make it more productive. And each member of that group gets a certain allowance of money for his own personal needs. And they have one crew in the kitchen, one or two people needed to take care of the babies during the day. Everybody else goes out to the field. Come in at noon and eat. Back to the field, they come in at night, eat. Then the father and mother go there for them with their children. And during the evening is the best time. And they start over.
I just found out the other day that they also have the industry over there.
Yeah.
I was talking to a woman in Florida, and her daughter is in a kibbutz there in Tel Aviv, and she said the minimum sign up is 15 months if they sign up for it. Of course, they can get out if they really want to. But
when it first started, it was voluntary. It was without a time element on it.
So she works in the industry over there. It's a kibbutz.
Yeah, they have several industrial kibbutzes. But it's not a place that you go to play. There you have to work. Some like it.
Is it somewhat a newcomer to the country?
This has been the government ever since the place was started. That kibbutz that I showed the other day that I couldn't think of the name of, out in the Galilee, is Yeganya. That's the oldest kibbutz in Israel. Moshe Dayan met his wife and married her. He grew up as a boy. And Levi Eshkol, one of the prime ministers before old George Meir, grew up in kibbutz. Abba Eben was in kibbutz. And whenever one of their leaders in the past have been in a kibbutz at one time, Mrs. George Meir was in the kibbutz in the ghetto plain. It was a swamp. And they went in there and helped to drain it out properly and make it productive. This is the a place you hear about, Masada. This kind of incline goes completely around that thing. And do you see the serpent's path? That's the only way you can go up by foot. And on top of this, some of the Jewish zealots took this in the early stages of the rebellion against Rome. And after they had taken Israel, Jerusalem in particular, captive, 70 AD, 3 years later before they took discipline, because in addition to this climbing this thing, they also have an 18-foot wall clear around it on the top. And it was just inaccessible. It was between 900 and 1,000 Jews up here. They had food that would have lasted them 3 years. And they had, in fact, Herod had developed this first as a retreat, which he could flee to in case of an attack from the colonies in Egypt, or in case of a severe rebellion of the Jews in Jerusalem. But it turned out to be so desirable that he had a palace down here, a real resort. And the people were very defensible. And the fellow on the top, in charge of the group on top, was Alexander Ben Yair. The man in charge of the crack tent legion of Rome was under the leadership of But the way they took this place, there's a on the other side, we're up on the east side of it now. On the other side, they built a ramp up the side of that thing, where they could, and the plan of attack was, they built a mobile fortress, really. They rolled up to the top of this thing, and in the top were fellows that were bow and arrow men. And the group in the bottom of the thing, once they had pulled these fellows down off the wall with those arrows, when while they were still down, these fellows at the bottom would go over the wall and fight the battle. But they built this thing, and for some reason they decided not to attack the next morning. Well, the Jews on the top knew what was coming, so they made a pact, and they all committed suicide. And so the next morning, when the Romans came up, no opposition, came over the top, and they'd seen fires up there all night long, but didn't know what was going on. They burned out the storehouses, so the Romans didn't get any food, and they just got a lot when they got up there after 3 years hard work. And so how do you know what happened up there? There was a woman took two or three little children and hid them on the caves up there. And when they came in, found her, she told them what had happened. In the oath that they take now, going into their armored corps in Israel, I understand they bring them down here to do it. And they take an oath, and part of that oath is, Masada never again. They will not let it happen in that fashion anymore. You say, well, why didn't the fellows on top destroy these fellows building the ramp? It would have been an easy matter. But they can hollow back and forth from the bottom to the top, and the other side is not quite as high as this one is. And so Flavius Silva, the man in charge of the 10th Legion, called up. They did not do fellows all for a while, and he called up and he said, look, we're building this with Jewish slave labor. And those out here that are building this thing are Jews. And for every Roman you kill, we'll kill 12 Jews. Well, of course, they were just committing suicide by trying to keep it down, so they quit. And they built the ramp to do it. This is the place between Masada and the north end of the Dead Sea. This is a place that's known as En Gedi. This spring comes out down through here. And in fact, I planned two of that area, that in that's a kibbutz down there. Now I intend to take a group down there to visit. This is where Saul, Saul after David, and David found him sleeping in the cave down there and cut his coattail off, let him know he'd been there. And he, David hit down in this area quite a lot because it was a spring there in the cave. This is near what is known as the what's the name of those? In those caves, the jars of
Kumon Cave.
Huh?
Kumon Cave.
Yeah, the Kumon. This guy goes to Kumon. That word from $1,000 right then. But this is not too far from there. It's in the wintertime. And I don't know what these camels are eating, but this one apparently right here has found something. But they are not working much during the winter period. They roam this way in that wilderness area with something to eat. This is down in the Negev, the harvest. When the melons get ripe, they've got to go to market right then. They don't stay around there and wait, especially in this hot sun. And so when it's harvest time, these boys that are in the military doff their jackets and pile in and help the harvest, which you can bet their guns are right there close. But they got to get that crop out of there while it's ready, and that's what they're doing here. And you can see in the background the kind of country it is. You can maybe throw a melon of any kind down here, but they're nice honeybees, they call them here. I don't know what they call them now. Still in the Negev, this is wheat crop going in the Negev. This is on the Dead Sea, Moab, Mount Moab in the background. It's some ways south of Tel Aviv. Come to Ashdod first, which you saw yesterday, and then farther on down you come to Ashkelon and the Dead Sea on the background. Pretty good resort. This is in the mountains of Gilead. The end of the mountains of Gilead were on the Trans-Jordan side, across the Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan River. And this is the old ruins of Jerash, J-E-R-A-S-H, that the Romans built there. Tremendous thing. They have a mile long here, these columns, down along the street, one of the streets there. And you notice the grass is nice and green here. Remember the fat cattle of Bashan? They were in the Gilead Mountains. This is the Romans, the ruins of the Roman people. Across the mountains now, the mountains of Moab, and where this is on the Trans-Jordan side. Still, I don't know. This is crossing the area that would be known as Ammon, children of Ammon. And it's cultivatable. Interesting to follow now this. You see, they cultivated this area. Remember the judgment that was pronounced upon Moab and Edom? We're going down south and we begin to still in the area known as Ammon. But coming south, you pick up Moab. And you see the difference. And you'll see a stray Bedouin tent occasionally down through there, but not much production there. Going on down there. Begin to enter Edom, a little, just a little south of here. This is Moab, close to that border between them. These are the mountains of Mount Seir, the north end of Mount Seir, in Edom. And you can see how barren it is. The sheep look pretty bad sheep. So they eat that old dry stuff that had a lot of protein in it. But it's nothing, no city or anything there. This is the north end of Mount Seir, in which Petra is located. In those mountains, you come to this narrow pass. And as you can see here, you can take a jeep through here, but that's about all that we can squeeze through. I don't know how far it can go through this channel because it's got pretty narrow and farther down. But as you come out of it, into Petra, this is the place you suddenly come out of the narrow pass, and here you're staring right in the face of the treasury building here in the Rose City of Petra. It's sandstone. The reason it's easy to cut these in the side of the rock mountain. So this isn't built, it's just carved out of the side of the mountain. The kingdom of Numidia was, it operated as this as the capital. Their kingdom one time went as far north as Damascus. They operated out of here as some renegade Arabs. I think they were Ishmaelites, in a sense, the best I can find. But they came from down around Aqaba, and they found this place, and the commercial traffic and whatever kind of traffic there was going from the Gulf of Aqaba to Transjordan or to Israel or to Damascus, and had to pass not far from the entrance here, as you saw here. Just outside of this, the road would pass. So these Arabs would charge every caravan that came through, and they were land pirates. They captured a lot of wealth that way. Finally, they got smart, and they said, hey, we can make a good deal here. We'll make an agreement not to raid your caravans, but you pay so much bounty for the privilege of bringing your caravans through this area. Otherwise, we raid them. So that was less trouble than both sides, and they started that, and that's the way the kingdom of Numidia was built. This is the treasury building here, and over here to the right, right between the two rocks here, you come around the corner and into the open area of Petra. You can see this sea, it looks like Roman columns here. Amphitheater built out here, and the open caves up here that are made for either for the actors to come out on stage. I think they were down here. I presume that must have been tombs or housing. It looks like housing. These are tombs. A lot of tombs there, as well as dwelling places, all that kind of thing. And I guess that's it. That is Mount Seir, really farther up there. There were some Arabs down there trying to catch all the tourists that come to do it. Some of them think it's a long time for a while. They don't start to get there before that. any questions come up you'd like to ask about that area before it's fresh on your mind?
What does that Mount Seir mean?
Mount Seir is Edom. You remember when the Israelites came out of Egypt, that they were told that they could not go into Mount Seir because that was given to Edom or to Esau. Esau is Edom. And they were forbidden to take this because it belonged to Edom. And yet, when they got into, who were the Moabites? Well, we haven't gotten that far yet, but the Moabites were distant relatives through the Abrahamic line, and that's where Balak tried to make the deal with Balaam. Balak tried to get Balaam to make the deal, and they finally did get it made. Hadn't been for donkey he was riding, he'd been killed. As long as they had more sense than he did. That Mount Seir range was where Esau was deeded to him, like the other end of Edom.
The name means, though, Edom
means red, I think.
Yeah, he is red.
Yeah. And that stone, if you notice, it's called the Red Rock City. It's a rose-colored stone. Apparently that's the kind of all of Mount Seir is, because all of this in here was. I have pictures inside that area that show some beautiful stone, just the native layers, different colors, kind of like striped zebra. This was the dwelling place of the Arabs. It's interesting to note in that country, the farther south you go, the more desolate it looks. And you're going to the Allenby Bridge, you approach it from the east, and the Jordan Valley on that side is long, flat area. They have a few little banana trees out there and a little citrus. But you cross the river on the Israeli side, and they're raising oranges by the truckload. And as I mentioned yesterday, I think, the 100 truckloads of oranges a day go across into Jordan, out of the Jordan Valley, on the Israeli side. They sell 100 truckloads a day in peak harvest. And yet, Jordan has the same thing on the other side of the river. You could flip a nickel across it down there. But they just don't apply the modern system of farming. They've always just had a little patch of this, a little patch of that. And that's what's still there.
Doesn't their bottom religious background hold them back for money?
Well, evidently so. They're very set against change. That's exactly what where Ayatollah Khomeini told his British Ian, he was going to try to turn the calendar back about a couple of thousand years or so. And they haven't been able to settle that deal with every cause that they had Western civilization, if you will.
Well, I'm thinking agriculture and high school. I have different teachers, and one of them gone over there to work in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go out there and kill those Arab people, cow plows, use tractors, and they grow the wheat for them, then they won't even
eat. Oh, they
won't harvest their wheat. They won't have it.
They're not very set foot. I saw on the Israeli side the Arab with his jalab on his head and his big deal, like they travel all the time, sitting in a new tractor plowing the land. But you don't find that over on the other side of the world. They are developing Saudi Arabia as trying to apply new methods of farming while they have the money to buy it and bring it into production, so when the oil plays out, they'll have something to show for it. most of the Arabs, they're just like Esau and Ishmael, just exactly. They just live from day to day and roam wherever they please and don't run away from a fight any time. But they don't know how to organize an army to make a good fight. That's the characteristic of Esau and Ishmael and their younger days. Yeah. They have wars among themselves. You've heard this Lawrence of Arabia. You hear the music once in a while was with us, and maybe you've seen the film sometime on TV. He was the fellow who, during the First World War, went from one Arab group to another and got them all formed into a solid army to fight for the British. And he led them in a group. It was the first time they ever were congealed into a solid army under one flag. But he'd go into one camp with a lot of these fellows following him. He'd spend a lot of time there getting to know the fellows and talking to them. And then he'd put the proposition to the head honcho, and they'd take off and there'd be one more. And he just had that one place to another. And really, Lawrence of Arabia, the fellow that won the Middle East in World War I. But the British, he thought he was going to have some say in what we do with it now. He fought the battle. Allenby just more or less marched in. But when they sat down at the table to decide what they're going to do with this land, how they're going to occupy it, he started to sit down and do this. No, we don't need you any longer. He said, you've done your job. You can go on home. And he was rather disgusted and heartbroken over the deal. After he fought and won the thing, he didn't have anything in the world to say about what they did with it. Lawrence of Arabia was a real man. He wasn't just fictitious fable. We will, in the text, begin. Let me get my book and show you. Someone needs to tell. Walter Cronkite, how to pronounce Wycliffe. He's talking about the Wycliffe translation. You can flip that switch off now, it'll be cool enough.
Okay.
Oh, it's on the back side. Black button. Thank you. You have to leave it there till it cools down before it turns on. The first thing we cover will be what we have seen in these film, the geography of the land and the history of it. And the geography, now it should register a little better that you have seen it. The first paragraph in that starting with Palestine is interestingly enough that right on the left-hand page they have that treasure building you've just seen. One reason they do that, it's such a beautiful layout and easily photographed with a wide angle lens that it makes they usually show that instead of the narrow pass that goes into it and some of the rest of the area. And it is part of the original area settled by Esau. Palestine, known in the Old Testament as Canaan. If you look at a map of Old Testament times, that Canaan written across the Sharon Plain. They lived primarily there. They were controlled the other area. And they have this song, you know, Canaan land among my way where the soul never dies. That's Canaan land. But it wasn't Canaan's land. He was there, but it wasn't his. It had been given to Abraham. And it extended from Dan at one of the Jordan sources to Beersheba in the northern Negev. Remember now I don't think I showed Beersheba. I got that picture in another prophetic series, but Beersheba is down a little south and east of Gaza. And so we saw that area, the general area there. And you hear the expression a lot, from Dan to Beersheba. Well, that's the reason, that's where the expression came from, because that's the land that Israel occupied when they came in from Egypt. Dan really wasn't supposed to be up there on the north end. He was supposed to have some land over there on the... Turn his map around, he's got the right map right here. He down here was his land, but he came on up here. And this is the Fertile Valley on here. And Naphtali had the fertile area, but Dan came to the mountain, the edge of the mountain, and settled there. And Beersheba gets its name from the agreement that Abraham and Abimelech reached over a well. A well was as valuable to the fellows in that country as gold bullion would be, because it wasn't much of it around. And when a well was dug, you remember Isaac went around cleaning out the wells that his father had dug one time. So they are very valuable. I think now, if I'm not sadly mistaken, that they're doing a lot of irrigation in the Negev from some deep wells they have sunk there. They found water underground. So that's where the expression came from, Dan in the north, Beersheba in the south, right at the bottom of that map. Let's see. A distance 150 miles. All right. If you say, man, they went from Dan to Beersheba, you think, man, they went a long way. But they didn't go any farther, much farther than here at Bakersfield. And it's a lot different territory. It's unbelievable, really, the different climates and different kinds of terrain you can find within that 150 mile stretch, or up 70 miles wide, in the widest place of Jordan. And on the other side of Jordan, remember when the Israelites came in, Gad and Manasseh, Reuben said, hey, we like this plain country. Remember, we started down across Ammon and Moab, and they're all flat plains area. And of course, it hadn't been cursed at that time, and it was good productive area. Mountains of Gilead were up in Manasseh's area. And they said, we'd like to settle this land. Moses said, okay, you can have it, but you've got to go across the river and help us whip the pants off of those people over there, and then you can come back and settle down. You're not going to get out of the fight and settle down over here. So they stayed with them until they settled the land, and then came back and settled on the east side of the Jordan. 150-mile long stretch. From Dan to Eves and Geber on the Gulf of Aqaba, where it's not quite on that map. Egyptian Sea or the Red Sea, where Solomon maintained a merchant fleet for Israel, is about 300 miles. So if you're going to go the full length of the country now, when Solomon, David won the area, Solomon enriched it, and until David was king, they didn't come that far down, but they have copper mines down there around that area, and they have Solomon puts them in operation. And after the Jews were run out, they just stayed there. Nobody did anything with them. But when Israel came back, they reopened those copper mines that Solomon had originally built down there. And they're still producing today. They were about ready to quit. They didn't produce enough to pay them to do it. And then the price of copper started going up, and they really started plowing then. And they're still producing. Wherever you find copper, you usually find turquoise. Or wherever you find turquoise, you usually find copper. It's connected with copper area. And they have a turquoise there, but they call it elatstone. So they got to have their own brand on it, you know. But it's what we call turquoise. A little different than most you see here. It's a little bit darker, a little more black work to it probably than what we commonly see here. But it is, it's like turquoise. It's found in the presence of copper. So, from Dan to Beersheba, 150 miles. From Dan to Elat, 300 miles.
Elat is a young Eber.
Eden Geber is the same thing. It was known as Eden Geber in Old Testament times. Before Israel came in, known as Elat now. From the Mediterranean to the edge of the Transjordan Desert at the latitude of Jerusalem is only 75 miles. Saying here is that from the Mediterranean Sea here, across at the Jerusalem level, only 75 miles across it. They, when the Israelites came in, they occupied land about 150 miles long and 75 miles wide, except for those who settled on the east side of the Jordan River. Now, this next paragraph is the thing that every group that I've taken in there had the same impression I did the first time I went in. It's a natural reaction to see so many biblical events that took place in so small an area. We think, you know, in terms of Texas or Alaska, from San Francisco to the East Coast, New York, but this is a small area. In this small area occurs a great variety of topography and climate. That's the thing that's surprising. The narrow coastal plains yields to the western highlands. Now, the coastal plains area, we don't have a relative. Coastal plains is this area along here. Plain of Philistia up to Joppa, and from Joppa now there's the plain of Sharon. Sharon is here. They also mention the plain of Dor up here, but really that's just an extension of Sharon. So I don't call that Dor as being a separate thing, but it really is very non-common. And above here is the famous copper, Asher.
The Piper right there on the far
border. Now, this is the port of Piper. The Gulf of Piper. And Piper is on the side of the mountain. We're over the other side. It's up quite heavily. But that narrow coastal plains area. I told you how to remember that, didn't you? Well, Amy found that out. PSA. Philistia, Sharon, Three plains on it. coastline. This narrow plain, on the western, east to the western highlands, that's the central mountain range that runs down right through the center. Extending southward from the Lebanon range of mountains is north, of course, in what is Lebanon now. Used to have large cedars on it, and that cedar, if they call the cedars of Lebanon, is what we more or less term as a spruce tree here. That's not what we think of when it's a little red cedar. They were tall, stately pines like the ponderosa pine or spruce up in the high mountain forest areas here. And the mountain range coming down here is only an extension of the Lebanon Mountains to the north that are much higher and tapering off down into toward the sea. The hill country of upper and lower Galilee, around the Sea of Galilee to the south and to the north, upper and lower Galilee, and then after a break at Esdraelon Valley, or that is the same thing as Megiddo. There are three locations. This plain in here is the plain of Megiddo. Here is Jezreel. The drain here of the mountain range comes down to the Jordan. You see the open pass into the plain. And this Israel isn't on this map, but it's down in this area here. And they bore the name of whoever had control of those cities at that time. The ghetto was the key to pass through into this, and the traders coming in through here. And so it's usually known as the Plain of Megiddo, but it is the Plain of Megiddo, Israelin, or Beersheba, of Jezreel. Break at Esdraelon Valley continues into Samaria. Samaria is, in Ephraim's territory, you see the word Samaria in the round ring at the right end of it, here. That is a high mountain. You remember that picture of that mountain that sloped about the same in all directions? That's where it's located. And from Esdraelon to this Samaria area here, and that's the lower Galilee. I work from Samaria to the Sea of Galilee. It's lower Galilee. From Galilee, the area from the Sea of Galilee on up north is upper Galilee. The eastern slopes of the highlands, which is on the Jordanian side, rapidly toward the Jordan Valley, which is 230 feet above sea level. And at Lake Hulin, which is a little lake up above there that is no more. One time we call Miriam, Waters of Miriam. It's not there anymore. They've been cultivating that area. But 695 feet below sea level at the Sea of Galilee. I have a question mark beside that 695 because that's the lowest, that's the highest altitude I've ever read. Most places will fix it at 800 or 900 feet below sea level. What they've done here, I think, is to give the level at the upper end of the sea, because notice that they point out here the eastern slopes of the highlands descend rapidly toward the Jordan Valley, 230 feet above sea level, at Lake Hulin.
from Maryland.
Okay, here. And then there, at that point, they're 230 feet above sea level.
You said that is the lowest figure?
Yeah, the 695.
What did you say,
800 to 900 feet below sea level is the figure that I've seen on that altitude, wherever I've seen it, beside this book here. But he says 690 feet below sea level at the Sea of Galilee, you're coming from the north down. So I presume they're giving the altitude at the north end of the Sea of Galilee.
In other words, it would be safe to preach the gospel.
Huh?
695. 695.
It wouldn't
be safe to preach the gospel, huh?
I think not. You're just 5 feet off of 700 feet, and I think you'll find that at least on the southern end where it enters out, that it's 800 feet below sea level. And the 1,285 feet below sea level at the surface of the Dead Sea. And again, they picked the upper end of it because they're giving the thing coming south. That is usually given at 1,290, 5 feet difference, make that much difference, below sea level, at the surface of the Dead Sea, where the bottom of the bottom of the Dead Sea, 1,300 feet lower than the surface. You think what a vat of minerals is in that thing. For thousands of years, that water coming through a lot of mineral springs from the north has fed into this sea that is 1,300 feet deep. And none of the minerals ever leave. The water is evaporated out and fed back in, gets more minerals when that's evaporated out. Fact of it is, that's where they had potash operation in the southern end down there. What they've done is step up the process of evaporation. And they've got potash. Really a simple thing, but...
It's a bank vault, isn't it?
Huh?
The name of the bank vault.
Yeah, it is. There's no way to estimate the value. I mean, I've heard they used to say that there was as much wealth in the Dead Sea as there had been money coined since the days of Julius Caesar. I haven't seen that expression quite some time, but you know, how would anybody know how much money had been coined since the days of Julius Caesar, in first place? Second place, it'd be an estimation over the Dead Sea's value.